big time executives walk in the room and we present for 6 hours. And that night we go to dinner. We have this great dinner. We go out with our champion after that. We're running on 4 hours of sleep and extreme adrenaline. We get in our Uber. We're heading back to our Airbnb. Our flight is at 6 a.m. We're sitting at a stoplight at midnight, and a car comes barreling into the back of our car and smashes into us, going 50 miles an hour. We get whiplash. We both turn around. I'm like 2 feet away from the guy that hit me because he's so deep into the back of this car. I lock eyes face to face with this guy, and I'm just like in shock. I'm like, what is going on? The guy puts it in reverse, goes around the car, takes off. Andrew and I are like, are we dead? Like, what just happened? Like, we've got whiplash, but we're kind of like big guys. And so, you know, whatever. So we take off. We go back to our Uber. We get there at like, who knows what time it was now, 1:30. We sleep for a couple of hours. We jump on a plane. We get back home and we got the deal. And so it was all worth it.
Hello and welcome to A More Intelligent Tomorrow. A wide-ranging exploration of the potential impact of AI on the world around us. As envisioned by the future heroes of the human and machine intelligence revolution. How fast will AI drive disruption in auto sales? We'll discuss this and more with Tyler Hall on today's episode. And now, your host, Ben Taylor.
Tyler, thanks for making time for us.
I'm excited, Ben.
You've got a lot of time, right? What's your day like? What's your schedule like as an executive?
Yeah, we do a lot of martinis. We do a lot of golfing.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of horse races, that sort of thing. No, it's every single day is just wild, right? So finding a block of time to block out, I know you can relate to this sometimes is challenging, but I'm super excited to be here. And, you know, I love what you're building with DataRobot. I love that organization. I want to say congratulations again on the new role. I think both of you guys won big in that deal. And so excited for you, man.
I really want to kind of go back to the beginning because a lot of the people that are listening, they may want to go do a startup and they may want to try to follow in your shoes and make some of the decisions you made. So what's the backstory for you?
Every founder starts a company for a specific reason, right? And a lot of times it's because somewhere, somehow, they identified that there was a problem and they felt like they had the ability to solve it, right? So when I was in college, I'm a 20-year-old kid. I'm going to school in Salt Lake City, Utah. All the craziest things you can do, I'm doing, right? School full-time, job full-time, newly engaged, like broke as a joke. And I'm making like nothing at my day job, right? So I'm struggling to get by. And I saved up enough money to buy my first car. I buy my car. It's a big day. I'm super excited. But my job all day, every day was to sell digital advertising on KSL.com, which is a classifieds in Utah. And so I'm at work the next day and I realize that the car that I had bought was worth quite a bit more money than I paid for it. And so what did I do? I listed it. And within about a week, I turned around and I sold it. And I made $3,000.
Wow. That's a big gap. And for a college kid, that's a ridiculous gap.
It was so much money. Like I was rich, right, at this time. It took me months to make $3,000 in my day job. And in a couple of days, I made $3,000. And so I didn't think a whole lot of it. I decided, you know what? I need another car. I need transportation. So I bought a car. I'm at work the next day. I get curious. I list it. I sell it. I make $1,000. So over the next 90 days, Ben, I had bought and sold like 20 cars. And I'm at the DMV one day. And this nice old lady who I worked with almost every time I was in there is like, hey, Tyler, do you have a dealer license that you want to put on file? I'm like, no. She's like, do you have a wholesale license? Are you a broker? Like, do you have any credentials? I'm like, no. Why? She's like, well, according to my records, you've bought and sold about 20 cars in the last 90 days, and that's illegal. In the state of Utah, you can only register 3 in a calendar year.
So not only was that illegal, but it's a huge miss. So she should have caught you on the 4th, right?
Huge miss.
Huge miss. Wow.
I'm thinking like, no big deal. Like, what do I need to do? Pay a fine? Like, I'm balling. Like, I got all this money now, right? You want me to pay a fine? And she goes, no, actually, this is like a class B misdemeanor. Like, you could go to jail. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm a 20-year-old kid. I'm just hustling, making money. She gives me this packet. It's like this thick. And it's, you know, information about how to become a dealer. And I go through it. And pretty quickly, I'm like, I'm not a car dealer. I'm a full-time student. I'm not a, car dealers are kind of gross. Like, that's not what I want to do. And so I hang it up. But like a week goes by and I had like lost the excitement of buying and selling cars. And so I figured out a loophole. And the loophole was, if I partnered with another dealer and used their dealer license number, I could continue to flip cars, but now I would just have to charge sales tax. And so I made it very clear over the next 9 months or so, I essentially built a, I built an API into KSL's platform where I could set the criteria on my end. And anytime a car matched that criteria, it would send a text message to my phone. And so I had automated searching for the cars, which was 90% of the work in buying and selling cars. Over the next like year and a half, I bought and sold like 150 cars. Literally every other day I was flipping a car. And I ended up licensing that software to a bunch of small independent car dealerships. And in doing that, Ben, the reason why this story is important is because every time I sat in front of a dealer and I said, hey, I have a solution that's going to help you buy better used car inventory faster, every single time they listened to me. So I knew that this was like a big problem, right? And most of them bought my solution. So as a young guy, I ended up making a little bit of money. I didn't know how to invest it, but I knew a lot about the car business. And so I invested in a car dealership. I was involved in that for about 3.5 years. I got to know the day-to-day operations really well. And I knew there was this big problem, which was this inventory problem. But I knew I was also kind of dumb and I didn't know how to like build a company. And so I had an advisor say, hey, you should go and get some experience. And that led to me joining a startup called Domo that went on to IPO and then joining a startup called HireVue that obviously exited for over $500 million.
Domo is a pretty high profile company within the Utah tech center because it's a Josh James company. He sold his first company to Adobe for $1.5 or $1.8 billion. And that really kind of seeded the Utah, what they call Silicon Slopes. And so you worked at, how long did you work at Domo?
So when I joined Domo, we were about 80 people or so. We had this little office that was kind of podunk and wasn't fully built out. Really, really fun environment. My brother knew Josh, the CEO, and so he put me in touch and I went and interviewed, right? And I got the job during the interview, which I think was just, maybe they were desperate, right? Because I wasn't that good. And, you know, I was there for 3 years. We went from 80 people to nearly 900 people. And we went from raising $5 million in capital, $5 to $10 million when I started, to raising $900 million in venture capital, which at the time was the highest funded SaaS company ever, right? And so the lessons that you learn in joining a company at that stage and quote unquote going to the moon are really valuable. Some are good, some are bad, right? And everything in between. And so that experience really helped me become the founder that I am today.
I heard early on every single sales meeting with a prospect, the prospect had to sign an NDA before they could even see a demo.
100%.
You were dealing with that on the sales process.
Yeah, it's a great call out, Ben, because I think that's one of the reasons why I became such a refined salesperson and sales leader is because before I could ever show anybody anything, they had to sign an NDA. And so I had to convince them first, before selling them a product or solving their problem, I had to convince them to sign an NDA. On every deal, there was thousands of these happening every single month. Hindsight, it seems kind of crazy, but it's what we did.
What drew you to HireVue, or was it pressure from Domo or some opportunity? What was the decision to make another jump and go to a different startup?
Domo, as amazing of a company as it was, I think it got to a point where culturally for me, it wasn't a great fit. So I had identified internally that it was time for me to go and do something else. I had also, at that point, made a name for myself, right? Being an early employee at a company that has that sort of growth, legitimate or not, right? You know, it really helped put me on a pedestal to where I had a lot of opportunities. And so initially, Ben, I was going to move to San Francisco. There was a couple of really exciting companies in San Francisco, some big, some small companies like Salesforce, Marketo, and others. And so I was headed to the Bay Area, and I got a call from the chairman of the board at the time of HireVue, and it was David Bradford. And so David was the CEO just not too long before then. He did a small stint as CEO, and then he stepped in as the board chair. And he said, hey, you know, we've got a number of roles. We're looking for smart people. I really didn't know what I was interviewing before when I walked in the door. And I walked in, and I had an interview, and it was, I think they were measuring me for a number of different roles. And the thing that ultimately they ended up hiring me for was to build out the renewals function. And so it became my responsibility to ensure that every single one of our customer contracts continued to pay us money, and that we took our renewal rates from somewhere around 74-75% to over 90% in the time that I was there. And so joined HireVue as well when we were about a $15 million a year business, was there just over 3 years. We were doing about $45 million at the time that I left, and had some amazing experiences. And I think one of my big takeaways from HireVue was what I learned about AI and machine learning.
That role with renewals, is that an adversarial role against sales?
Yeah, so that challenge that you're talking about didn't lie with sales. It lied with customer success, right? Mm-hmm. The salesperson sold the deal a year ago.
Okay.
And then they were managed for an entire year by a customer success manager. And so when an account wasn't healthy, really that lied on the relationship manager, which we called customer success, right? The bigger challenge that we had in developing this organization was historically sales reps handled the renewals themselves. So if they closed a deal, 12 months later, they were responsible for renewing that deal. And so once I came in, I kind of became the bad guy for a little bit, where salespeople were like, wait a minute, this is part of our comp plan. This is part of how we make money, is to renew these accounts. I closed those accounts. I should continue to get paid on them. And the business thought differently for a number of reasons. And so my internal battle was to convince the salespeople that, look, you should be spending your time doing what you're good at, which is net new sales, closing new business. And that's it. And you should spend 100% of your focus there. And we got the business really aligned around that. And it really changed our business, right? A SaaS company is only as good as their ability to retain and maintain customer contracts, right? So if you think of a bucket, right, this is kind of the way that I always talked about renewals, and you poke some holes in the bucket and you've got water flowing in from the top. If the inflow is more than the outflow, right, the holes, then you have a growing business. If the outflow, the water coming out of the holes, is ever higher than the inflow of business, right, then essentially you're drowning and your business is as good as dead over time. And so my responsibility was to look at these holes and plug as many as we can, and so we could continue to grow the amount of water that was in a bucket. And over a few years, we built some really good processes, had an amazing team, amazing leadership to do that.
You're listening to More Intelligent Tomorrow, an artificial intelligence podcast brought to you in high fidelity by Data Robot.
The great thing with everything that you're talking about is really speaking to the difficulty of not only selling AI products, but communicating that to a lay prospect or to a lay user. So I met you at HireVue, and I remember being on some of these sales calls early on, and I'd listen to the sales guys and I'd cringe. They'd said big data 5 times on one call. But I would say no one knew how to sell it. So like, not even the data scientists know how to sell it. So what was that experience like going into a prospect and you're going to sell them an AI SaaS solution?
One of the first big deals that we did, so essentially my team was responsible for upsells in many of these accounts as well. And so once we called it HireVue Insights in the beginning, if you remember, once the Insights platform rolled out, that became a real focus for me and for my team to upsell our current customer base. And so one of the very first big deals that we did was with TMX Finance. And I believe this is very public. And we sold them an Insights deal. And I remember first having these conversations and trying to sell them on the machine learning widget that we had built. And this amazing, you know, data science and IO psychology coming together to produce these really meaningful insights. And them going, huh? Like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, what do you mean? Like, this doesn't make sense. For us internally, it made a lot of sense because we lived it, we breathed it every single day. And it wasn't until I was able to hone the craft of essentially telling a customer, like, we had to understand, why are we even building this? It wasn't for the AI. It wasn't for the ML. It wasn't for, you know, the insights or the micro expressions that we measured on a candidate's face using machine learning. It wasn't for any of that. What it was for was hiring managers across the globe inside of companies are inherently biased, and they have an extremely hard time identifying the right talent for any given role. And we had a solution that leveraged AI and machine learning to precisely predict who the right person was for the role that they were struggling to fill. They had a problem, and the problem was, we can't get the right talent in the right role. And we had a solution, and it was, We can help you put the right talent in the right role. So it wasn't until I really put myself in their shoes to say, why are we even solving this? And at the end state, what are we providing? And it's, we're providing the right talent for the right role.
So listening to you talk, I'm never going to think about car dealer the same way again, because I love the idea of like the misdemeanor. So it's almost like you being a car dealer is extra shady because you've got cars in your pocket somehow. Or we're going to meet at night and you're going to sell me some Escalade. What's the next part of this story?
After HireVue, financially was in a place where I felt comfortable leaving quote unquote corporate America, right? And doing my own startup. Once we did that, we had two options. We could either start building technology right out of the gate, or we could become our own customer and do that for a period of time to really, truly understand the problem that we're solving and what it's like day to day to operate as a car dealer. And so we opened a car dealership in Chandler, Arizona. It's called Auto Haul, right? After my last name, easy to remember. And we incubated a couple of different software companies there. One of the problems that we solved was this private consumer problem. Private consumers have a really hard time selling their vehicle. And so we solved that issue by providing them with a process and technology that made it easy for them to sell their car, convenient, fast, and they got a fair value. The second thing we solved for was car dealerships have a plethora of data and information to make good decisions on what cars to buy. Okay, back to my college experience and helping car dealerships acquire the right inventory.
I guess they have data you never had, right?
Yeah.
Like you had it, but you only had it to the tune of 150 cars, and they've got bigger numbers, right?
That's right. That's right. They have tons of information, but the automotive industry is it's pretty antiquated. It's pretty old school, right? And so this information wasn't being utilized effectively. And I had become dangerous enough at HireVue with my curiosity around AI and machine learning. You know this, I spent a lot of time with you kind of picking your brain and your team as you built out the data science team. And so I knew that the problem that dealers were facing in acquiring the right cars really rooted in not understanding the data effectively. And I also knew that the problem we solved at HireVue was much more complex than the problem that dealers were facing with inventory. And so I knew it could be done. And so we started building technology that essentially would take all this data nationally. We'd look at information data in a market, things like what cars are for sale, what cars have sold historically, what are cars transacting at the auctions in a wholesale environment. And then we would look at a dealer's internal historical data. What cars have you bought and sold? How have those cars performed over time? How much money did it cost you to recondition each specific car? And by combining these two data sets, we knew that it would produce much more meaningful insights to help a dealership understand what car to buy, where to buy it from, and how much to pay to maximize profitability and ensure that you have the right cars on your lot for the consumers that are going to come in to your store. This was what we learned in doing Auto Haul. We did that for 1 year. And then after 1 year, we made the full-time leap into starting Drivably.
So everything you described makes a lot of sense. You've got a lot of historical data. You have targets and outcomes you can trust because they're real. They're not subjective. Like in HireVue, we had performance ratings and stuff that got a little gray. Like, can you really trust the data? But you've got buying information. So obviously people are already using a lot of machine learning in this space, right? Like, are you coming into a busy vertical? How technical are car dealers?
I would say 25% of them. Okay, there's 70,000 car dealerships in the US alone. 20% of them or so do not use a financial system to track their financials, right?
So they don't even save their data?
No. No.
So I'm expecting this, and you're actually saying, you know, they're down here in F rating when it comes to data quality.
Yeah, right. And it's and these are mostly the small mom and pops, right? But the majority of the industry, with a few exceptions, there's a couple of guys, and I'll call them out, that do it really well. Guys like CarMax and Carvana. And a number of others that are on that top tier, they do a good job at utilizing technology to run their business. And they look more like tech companies than they actually do car retailers, right? So when we came into the space, when we did Auto Haul as a proof of concept, we identified probably 50 different problems that existed in the space that we thought we could solve using technology that literally nobody else had solved, right? And so the opportunity in this space is massive. And it was all about, okay, which one are we most passionate about? Which one do we think is the biggest opportunity? And, you know, which one can we get behind ultimately for the next 10 years while we go build a big company? And it came down to this inventory problem that dealers have. Because ultimately, if they can't buy the right cars at the right price, their business is as good as dead, right? So it's a big problem in the industry.
One of the criticisms with AI is it's cart before the horse. So you got the cart. How are you going to get this horse and start building up machine learning? What's that process like?
I guess the real answer, Ben, is if I pretended I knew at that time, I'd be 100% lying, right? The journey that we went on was, there's this problem. We've identified it. We know it's real. But frankly, Ben, I had no idea how to solve it. I didn't, right? And so the thing I did and the thing that I'm good at, one of the few skills that I would say I'm actually very good at, is attracting the right people and putting the right people in place, right? And so through my network, I started having a number of conversations. I ended up bringing on, right out of the gate when we transitioned Drivably, first of all, we had this massive customer contract that wasn't signed yet, but it was right there. And we had to scale up the business really fast to support that. Well into the six-figure contract, like day one out of the gate, right? And so we staffed up our team. At the time, I think we had 12 or 13 people full-time, which in a startup, in its first week or 2 weeks, is massive, right? It was it was huge. One of those people was a CTO that we brought on board, which was very, very talented, worked for a number of big companies, one of the biggest automotive tech companies in the world. He was formerly one of the head of engineering's at. And so we thought, this is going to be great. He's going to help us build an MVP and did a lot of really good things. But I think in the first 6 months, we learned some really valuable lessons, right? One of these things was, don't overstaff your team unless you have pen to paper, right? We didn't have a signed contract. We had a verbal commitment, but it wasn't signed. So we staffed up. And for only 2 months or so, we burned a bunch of money, right? And we brought about $500,000 of our own capital into this deal. Okay. So I had a friend that was an investor in Auto Haul, and we brought that money into this deal. So we had a little bit of a baseline of seed capital, angel capital that we were using to grow the business. Had this big deal, hired all these people, deal falls through, literally have to let go the entire team, right? I've convinced a bunch of people to come and believe in me. And we had to let go 7 people when that deal fell through. And so we were then on to not worrying about necessarily customers and revenue. And it was all about, okay, now we have this startup. We don't have a lot of cash in the bank. We're leaning out the team. We've got a great CTO. We need to build a minimum viable product. We still don't have a data science person on the team. The CTO was highly technical, and a couple of our developers were really good. I would say pretty high level understanding of BI and data architecture and things like that. So they were dangerous enough. And we built an initial product over a period of about 6 months, 6 or 7 months. And 7 months in, you know, we had a come to Jesus moment, which we realized was the product we had built was not the right product. It was not going to be scalable. It was not going to be the product that customers wanted to use. And frankly, we didn't have the right people in place to build the thing that we needed to build. And so 7 months into our business, Ben, we scrapped the entire initial product. And that was one of the hardest decisions I've ever had to make. And one of the darkest days of my life was deciding to do that, because we had spent lots of time and lots of money and energy in building this. And now we're starting back from zero.
As a founder, you're getting ripped in two, because if you have that many people on payroll, I imagine there was momentum, there was excitement. You're looking around the office and you're having the reverse. You're having all this excitement and energy and you're just like, I can't believe it. Like, this is working. We're going to change the world. And so with a founder, typically you have emotions in this range as an employee, but as a founder, the worst day of your life, the best day of your life. How do you come into work tomorrow after you go through something like that?
I don't get too high generally emotionally, and I don't get too low emotionally. I try to stay pretty even keel, and I try to keep my sights on the long-term focus, right? Especially in making decisions like firing employees, The way that I view that, Ben, is as horrible of a thing as it is, because it is horrible and you're impacting people's lives. And these are people, by the way, that are like your family. You spend more time, way more time with these people than you do your wife and your kids. And so it's extremely difficult, right, having those conversations. But the way I view it is as a way to protect the rest of the organization and the promise that I've made, which is the vision ultimately that we're all going after in a successful outcome.
But the employees that are being let go, they don't see it that way, right? Because the employees that are being let go, they don't see it from the founder perspective. They don't see you had no other choice. They don't see that it's not an insult to them.
When they ask you, they look you dead in the face, and many have tears in their eyes, and they say, why did you do this, right? Tyler, you sold me on this opportunity that we were going to build something great together. And I did, and I do everybody that we bring into the business. But I equally sell them on the fact that if they cannot produce the thing that we're hiring them to produce, and they don't fit certain core values and standards that we have as a company, they will not be with the team for very long, right? And so I think people respect that on the front end, but it's never expected when you let somebody go. And it's difficult to have those conversations. But look, investors have entrusted me with their money. Other employees have entrusted me with the ride of a lifetime, basically. And I have to protect those things. And that comes first. And so while it's hard, keeping my sights on that focus is how I get through it. I sort of view my days like a machine or like a robot. And some people will call me robotic or methodical in how consistent I do my daily routine. I virtually do the same version of the same thing every day, starting at 4:30 in the morning and ending at about 9 o'clock at night. Yes, I go to bed at 9 p.m. because sleep is a very important equation for me in having successful days day after day and never having a lull. And so when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I do is I drink a full glass of water. Just Google the cognitive advantages of having a full glass of water in the morning, and you'll understand why I do that. The second thing I do is I meditate. I think it's really important to clear your head, right? I used to think people that meditated were kind of weird. Mm-hmm. And I started doing it a couple of years ago, and it's changed my life. The third thing I do is I pray. I'm somewhat spiritual, and so I generally like to pray. I spend some time thinking and pondering. I do a journal entry for the day. I do about 30 minutes of study. And then by 5:30, I go to the gym every day, and I exercise. And I exercise more so, yes, to keep my body healthy, but 90% of the reason why is, again, the emotional and the cognitive benefits of exercising, right? Yeah. The days that I miss, it's noticeable for me. I don't function the same. My head is not as clear. I don't have the same amount of energy. And so exercising in the morning becomes really important. And then I have that block of work during the day, which is generally about 7 a.m. to 6 or 7 p.m. I block out time in the evenings. I'm not perfect at this. My wife will tell you that. But I try to be really intentional about blocking out time every day with my kids when I'm in town. And so I'll spend a couple of hours with them, an hour or two with them at night. We'll have dinner as a family. The kids go down. Generally, I'm spending another hour or so working, answering emails, kind of wrapping up the day. And then I go to sleep and I do it all over again the next day, day in and day out. And so this routine and this methodical approach that I take, I think, is one of the things that helps me continue to just push on day after day, regardless of what result we achieve that day.
You're listening to More Intelligent Tomorrow, an artificial intelligence podcast brought to you in high fidelity by Data Robot.
Getting back to the machine learning, first you have to build out a product, you have to get the data. It sounds like there are a few missteps where you had to, and that's very common with the startup. You think this is happening, it doesn't happen, you get more information, you have to pivot. Once you finally get the data, maybe explain that from getting the data and going to getting a model that's ready to review with a customer. Where does the talent come from? Where does the data come from? What are the timescales dealing with that?
The start of this process starts with, we had some investors encourage us to go out and get what we call design partners. Okay, so we were not a revenue generating business at this time. We had already taken on about $1.5 million of capital. We can get back to the fundraising efforts, because I think they're fascinating and some really good learnings in that as well. But we'd raised about $1.5 million in venture funding, and we were still pre-revenue. We had some investors and advisors encourage us to go and get what's called design partners, which are essentially paying customers that are helping you with R&D, right? Mm-hmm. So the mutual benefit to that is you're creating something for them that's going to create value for their business. And in turn, they're giving us an unfair share of their time and energy and resources to help us build and test new products, okay? And so the DNA of who I am is a go-to-market sales front-facing person. And so going out and getting these contracts was like, great, yeah, I can go do that, right? So my co-founder and I went out and we signed up a couple of design partners. We had discussions with about 10 big groups in the US. Essentially what we sold them was, hey, we are a data science company. Okay, this is, by the way, before we had a data scientist, okay? We are a data science company that specializes in collecting lots of information in your market, including your historical sales data, and pairing that together to precisely help you understand what cars to buy, how much to pay, and where to buy them from to optimize for profitability and run a better business, right? And they believed us. They said, that sounds amazing. It's similar to what CarMax does internally, but that nobody else has commercialized and helped other dealers do. And so they believed us, and we had two big groups take a chance on us.
Why are they believing you? You weren't promising them an R value. You weren't talking about AUCs. You weren't showing them scatter plots. You had an advantage because you already understood their problem from their shoes. And everything you just said has nothing to do with traditional statistics. You're speaking KPIs that they know. And so I think that probably built huge confidence with them. You know the problem and you weren't confusing.
Yeah.
AI has to be mapped to value. And everything you just described was product to value with AI somewhere in the middle, but it's not really the center of the story. It's kind of it's a tool in the background. So yeah, keep going.
Yeah. So literally, Ben, the first, this story is just crazy. The first customer, the first design partner that we brought on board was a 150 store group, like one of the top three biggest groups in the US by store volume. And we fly out to this undisclosed city. Our flight's at 9 p.m. local time, our time, and we're flying to the East Coast. Okay. We're supposed to land around, I don't know, 1 o'clock or something. Maybe we're leaving at 7 or 8 o'clock our time. We're leaving late our time. We're supposed to land around 1 a.m. And our meeting is supposed to be at 9 a.m. the next morning. Okay, it's the biggest meeting of our life, easily. We have all the executives there. We're trying to close them on doing this design partnership with us. And our flight is delayed multiple hours. Okay, but it's not just delayed. It's one of those delays where, like, you sat on the tarmac, like the AC wasn't working. The guy next to me was like sweaty and gross, right? And it was just like, it was one of the really annoying delays. Mm-hmm. We finally get there. It's 3 a.m. We get to our Airbnb at 3:30. It's the sketchiest Airbnb in this city that there probably is, right? Because we're a startup and we're on a budget. And so it's me and Andrew, my co-founder, and we walk into this place and we're like, we're pretty sure we're going to die tonight. But if we make it to tomorrow, here's what we're going to do, right? We were pretty well prepared for the meeting, but we were so tired. We go to bed. We wake up like 4 hours later. We've got to drive. We've got to take an Uber like an hour to this meeting or 45 minutes. We drive there, we get there, we walk in, our eyes are bloodshot, we're looking like zombies, and the guys go, "You guys okay?" We're like, "Ooh. Yeah, we're really tired." Like,
yeah, that's kind of bad to start a meeting that way, right? The first impression.
So we're like, "Guys, we're really tired. We didn't even have time to get like an energy drink or a coffee. Like, do you have anything?" Right? And they go, "Yeah, I think we've got some monsters and like, you know, somebody's got some monsters in here." So they went and found us a couple of monsters, and Larry, we pounded these monsters and we're sitting there with our champion. We're waiting for the rest of the team to come in. All these big time executives walk in the room and we present for 6 hours to their team and multiple teams. And that night, you know, running on adrenaline, we go to dinner. We have this great dinner. We're a startup. We end up paying like $1,000 for this dinner, right? Because we're trying to get this deal and we know what it takes to get these large enterprise deals. So we do this really nice dinner. We go out with our champion after that. You know, we're having a good time. It's like 11:30, almost 12 o'clock. Okay. So we're running on 4 hours of sleep and extreme adrenaline. We get in our Uber, we're heading back to our Airbnb. And by the way, our flight is the next morning at 6 a.m. Okay. We're sitting at a stoplight at midnight and a car comes barreling into the back of our car and smashes into us, going 50 miles an hour. We get whiplash. We both turn around. I'm like 2 feet away from the guy that hit me because he's so deep into the back of this car. I lock eyes face to face with this guy. And I'm just like in shock. I'm like, what is going on? The guy puts it in reverse, goes around the car, takes off. Somebody else happened to be sitting at the light perpendicular to us, goes through the red light, tries to chase that guy down. We're outside of the car. Andrew and I are like, are we dead? Like, what just happened? Like, we've got whiplash, but we're kind of like big guys. And so, you know, whatever. Fire truck shows up, ambulance shows up. We're like, dude, we got a flight in like 5 hours and we're running on like steam right now. You know, we've got to get back. The guy comes back who was chasing him down, said, hey, one of the guys jumped out of the car. We called the police, told them where he went. The other guy took off in the car. And we're just like, okay, whatever. So fire truck showing up, we call another Uber. We're like, we're out of here. We're not standing around to give a report. So we take off, we go back to our Uber, we get there at like, who knows what time it was now, 1:30. We sleep for a couple of hours, we jump on a plane, we get back home, and we end up getting the deal. We find out the next day that we got the deal. And so this roller coaster of emotions, and one of the craziest just 24 hours of my life, but it all came back to, we had one goal in mind in doing all of that, and we got the deal. And so it was all worth it.
So I'm sure people are wondering this. How did you build their confidence that you guys knew what you were doing with machine learning?
Probably a week or two before that, we ended up engaging with a guy who was a really talented BI architect and data science guy that had been in the industry for about 10 years. You know, we convinced him to come and help us with this deal.
Okay.
And so he got on the call. That their chief risk officer, who is a highly intellectual man, I'll just leave it at that, and always the smartest guy in the room, was on the phone, was in the call. And so we had our data science subject matter expert on the call as well, who was also very, very technical. And so it did get to a point in the conversation where, great, I understand the value that you guys are creating. Help us understand how you do it. We have our own data science team internally. We think that this is potentially something that we can build ourselves. We want to know that what you're going to build is going to be substantially different or something that we're just simply not capable of doing, right? Mm-hmm. And so Paul on our side did an amazing job in that meeting of speaking directly to their technical folks. And we probably spent 30 minutes to an hour is all in a total of 6 hours, getting really, really deep and technical. Without him, I'm not confident that we got that deal. We needed him to be on that call.
So you can kind of see my spidey sense going off, like, how did this deal happen? Like, especially with AI, because normally you kind of have to bring some heavyweight and sometimes for you sure. Do a lot of posturing with that. So,
yeah.
So you do the deal, you get the data. How long does it take to go from data to a model that you're willing to share? What are the time scales? What's that part of it look like?
We basically gave ourselves enough time to where we felt very confident that we were going to be able to pull this off. Okay. So we asked them to sign a 12-month agreement with a 6-month cliff, essentially. Okay. So They're going to have 6 months where during that time, it's going to be data collection. It's going to be essentially the first iteration of a model that we're going to build. And by the end of 6 months, we are going to have a live model deployed inside of their business. If they are confident in that live model and some of the early results that we have gleaned from that model, then they will opt into the next 6 months of the contract, which is essentially live testing inside of their environment and continuing to validate and refine the model that we built, right? And so luckily they did that. We pulled it off in the first 6 months. We're now in the second 6 months of that. We're testing it. It's producing amazing results. And, you know, at the end of 12 months, we'll have a conversation about, you know, potentially a multi-year deal at the end of this thing.
I know we talked offline and you don't have to mention names, but you recently raised some new money from a sports car company. You don't have to mention the name. Is that like, and this might be public in about 4 weeks and this can be edited out, but what are you willing to share about that?
Yeah, I'll just share that I don't think this team would be uncomfortable with me sharing this. They're very excited about the investment. We're trying to plan the press release around a very specific date and time. And so it'll come out in probably the next, 4 to 6 weeks or so. But a large German manufacturer, arguably the number one manufacturer of sports cars and supercars, I would argue, in the world, recently invested in Drivably. And we're extremely excited to have them on board. They've been great partners up to this point already. We are going to be launching a national pilot with them as well, which they have about, it'll probably be somewhere between 50 and 100 rooftops that we deploy this in. And so, excited to have their backing, excited to have their name, their connections, and everything that they bring to the partnership.
That's awesome. So congratulations. They're really tipping your hat to what you guys are doing and really what the opportunity is. So one more question I'll ask. Data robot, we've been obsessed with AutoML, machine learning. How do we get things into production faster? How do we provide the pipeline? So with the data sets that you got that you're working on, if you had been able to go from data to production worthy model within 1 week, ready for feedback and review. So 2020 hindsight, we can just make stuff up. If you'd been able to do that in 1 week, or if you had known that, what would that have done? Like any reactions to that, if that had been an option or if that had been doable using your team with extra technology? So what, taking 6 months to a week, what's your reaction to that? Yeah. You can react and say, I don't believe it. I don't believe that you can do that. Like you're fine to have that reaction, but.
If you go back through the email archives in Data Robot, you'll see that we engaged with Data Robot really early on. And we looked at, do we partner specifically with Data Robot to build this, or do we build it in-house, right? Mm. And we chose to build it in-house. However, I look at what Data Robot is capable of doing, and you don't make every decision perfectly, but I do believe that, and I will plug Data Robot because I have friends that have used the company and just raving reviews, and it's obvious in your guys' growth. I do believe that the cycle time would have been significantly shorter if we ended up partnering with somebody like you guys. So I'm actually not going to close the door on that. I still think there's real opportunity for us to do something together. But obviously, as you grow and as you continue to raise subsequent rounds of financing, investors a lot of times like to see that at least you have a team internally that's working directly with a firm like Data Robot to build your technology. So
yeah, and that, actually to kind of put more weight on that, one of the things that comes up a lot is intellectual property. So who has this intellectual property? Is it you guys? Is it another vendor? And so that's definitely something that comes up a lot with AI providers, because I do know that there is pressure internally there has to be kind of some strategic insight or something novel that is unique to you. And there could be a whole other tangent on patent versus trade secret. But now that you guys are kind of moving on in the new round that you guys raised from a badass sports car company, talk about what you're hiring for, what you're looking for. Want to make sure if there's people that listen to us where, want to do you the favor of getting right talent pointed to you guys as you get ready for the next stage. So maybe talk about, for any of the listeners you want to speak to, what do you want to say to them now about talent or opportunities to come reach out to you?
Yeah, I mean, Drivably, thanks, Ben, for giving the opportunity. Drivably is, in my opinion, has to be one of the most exciting companies at our stage, meaning between the seed and the Series A. We recently, just to give you an update, right, we're coming out of a global pandemic. And amid all of that calamity, we recently acquired a Canadian-based company, software company. During that acquisition, for the last 2.5 weeks, we've been selling their product. We have quadrupled our monthly recurring revenue. Not going to talk about specifics, but well into the six figures that will allow us to raise a giant Series A early next year. And we're obviously looking for the best of the best, right? And one of our biggest needs right now is we need to hire a head of data science. And so we've got a great data science team that's taken us this far. It's time for, you know, a new leader to come in who's going to help us prepare for our next stage of growth. And again, I think Drivably is the place to be. We're going to raise a giant round. I think our likelihood of success, right? A lot of companies at this stage, they're unsure of their likelihood of success. And I've had that in the past for, you know, the first year of doing the company. I'm as certain now as I've ever been in our likelihood of a giant outcome, whether that be an IPO in 5 to 10 years or whether that be an acquisition. It feels more inevitable today than it ever has. And so we need a top tier head of data science. We want somebody that's scrappy. We want somebody that wants to do a startup. And so bring it on. You know, we'd love to talk to anybody who's interested.
Awesome. This is going to be going out to a pretty massive data science audience. So a lot of people that are listening, kind of listening to you and my perspective, you know, you get your first data science job, junior, senior, principal, people that have shipped models into production, they understand the pains of dealing with that. They understand the awkward conversations that come from customers, data to value. But they also understand kind of this obsession with how do you stay up to date? Because it's not your job as a CEO to stay up to date on the latest and greatest technology. You have to depend on people to tell you that this is the opportunity. And the terrible thing with AI that impacts all these technophiles is we chase the shiny new toy. And so you're looking for someone who's really coming seasoned with a few scars, where they're not going to chase the shiny new toy and they're going to hammer away value, but lead a team of maybe some deep technophiles where they can, like, they can go deep on tech. And that's what we did at HireVue. We had super deep tech where it was fine. They didn't have to talk to a customer. They could read white papers and they could get to the bottom of the hardest problems, but you needed someone to manage them that, like, I loved when you were talking about the metrics and value. No R value, no accuracy, no AUC. Like,
yep.
Just talking to KPIs, which sounds so silly coming from a sales perspective, but that is very unusual in the AI sales space. That doesn't happen.
Now, I will say for non-technical founders like myself, you have to be dangerous, right? You have to understand enough about that world, but it's really not your responsibility to feel like you have to know it as well as your data science team, or you have to be writing lines of code. It's not practical. It's not realistic, but you got to know a little bit, right? Because you're going to get asked questions.
Well, if I found out you were writing code, I'd short your startup. Not because I think you would be bad at coding, but I would think you were very distracted from your roles and responsibilities. So thanks, Tyler. It's been a pleasure. So good to catch up and hear what you guys are working on. I'm super bullish on you guys. I'm expecting to hear great news. And the listeners will hear some really good news when that announcement comes out. So super excited for them to follow up with that.
Thanks, man. It's awesome.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of More Intelligent Tomorrow. Feel free to subscribe to continue discovering the heroes of tomorrow, illuminating the path forward today. Visit us at datarobot.com/AI-heroes/podcasts to learn more.